Veterans Radio has a partnership with Literature of War Foundation to exchange podcast content to reach a wider audience regarding issues of interest to veterans, family, and friends. You can find more about Literature of War Foundation at its website, litofwar.com. You can find more about Veterans Radio on Facebook or its website, veteransradio.org. I am Jim Foss-Hone, a host of Veterans Radio and a veterans disability lawyer at legalhelpforveterans.com, a sponsor of this podcast. In today's episode, Lit of War is talking to Army Ranger, editor, author Marty Soakland, Jr. He's talking about his new book, Send Me, which tells the powerful story of Shannon Kent, a Navy cryptologist who rose to really elite status on military intelligence. She spent a career hunting the world's most ruthless terrorist. Marty is the editor-in-chief of Task and Purpose. He's a former Army Ranger. He's got all the experience you'd expect from somebody on assignments who's actually reported from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Ukraine. So enjoy this Literature of War podcast.
Welcome to the Lit War Podcast by Lethal Minds Journal, where we seek out the moments that made us who we are today, one story at a time. I'm your host, Michael Jerome Plunkett, and my guest today is Marty Soakland, Jr. Marty is the editor-in-chief of Task and Purpose, a military news and culture publication. He is also a former Army Ranger and an experienced conflict reporter who has reported on assignment from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Ukraine, in addition to embedding with the U.S. military around the world. Send Me, the incredible true story of a mother at war, which follows the heroic life of intelligence operative Shannon Kent, is his first book. He joins us today with a story.
Marty Soakland, welcome to the Lit War Podcast. Do you have a story for us?
Oh, this is the Lit War Podcast. I thought this was the War is Lit Podcast. I was like, war is pretty lit. There's definitely some doozies, you know, but generally. Okay. So this is about books and stories and stuff, right?
You're correct.
Literature.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's my other podcast. That's not coming out for like another 6 months or so.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm on the same page now. Thanks for having me, Mike.
So what's your story? Important moment in your life. Hit me with it.
Yeah. You know, so I was, without going into the details of it, I was supposed to go on another podcast that got pushed. But one of the things that they told me to think about ahead of time was a time that you witnessed courage. And so I'd really been thinking about that when you told me, hey, have a story ready. I kind of just, because I'd been thinking so much about that. That's kind of what I'll go with my story. And it's really not my story so much as something that I witnessed. I'll take you back to, it was 2017, summer of 2017, and I was back in South Dakota, where I'd grown up, and we just, my wife and I and our daughter, we'd just gotten off of a year-long van trip across the U.S. We came back because to my hometown because we found out my dad was sick. It turned out he had ALS, and that was also, that year that we were back was also my youngest sister's senior year of high school, and she was joining the Army. Her plan was to go in and be a medic, and you know, she wanted to get into you know, some sort of medicine later on. And so, and obviously had the influence of not just me, my brother, but so many other people in our family joining the military, that was the route she was going to go as well. You know, when she made that decision, I don't think she was fully aware that our dad was sick, or you know, had this, you know, ALS, there's no getting out of it. To this day, you get that, you will die from it. That is, there's no, and so I don't know that she knew that, but obviously her senior year, we went through this and kind of saw my dad slowly sort of slip away, I guess is the only way to say, is, you know, the body really deteriorates, right? And it got to the point where it was June 2017, she'd graduated high school, and it was the day that, you know, the recruiter came to pick her up and you know, take her down to MEPS to then ship off to basic training, right? And it was, you know, we were all over there to say goodbye to her. And my dad at that point was somewhat immobile. And for the most part, he could make audible noises. And you kind of learned how to interpret those audible noises. But it definitely wasn't full, clear English, you know, at that point. And just so people know, ALS, there's sometimes you can have the complications of dementia along with it. But for the most part, it literally just affects the physical body, not so much the mind. So as far as we know, my dad was, you know, still very much of sound mind, but just couldn't use the muscles required to speak very well. Well, it got to the point where it was time to say goodbye. And, you know, the recruiter was there, and we all knew, you know, the elephant in the room was that Molly's going away, my sister. There's a really good chance that by the time she graduates basic training or gets her first leave, that dad won't be here anymore. You know, he was definitely at that stage. And so for her, you know, we all kind of cleared out of the living room and let her have a minute. We all stood outside waiting because she was going to say goodbye and then immediately get in the car with the recruiter and go. And I remember us all walking out, and it was a little bit of an emotional moment already, just because we all knew she was saying goodbye really for the last time. And when I think about how courageous that was, because anybody that's ever been in the military knows, you know, if you've got a parent dying, you can get out of just about anything in the military, right? Including delaying going to basic training or, you know, something like that. But she stuck with her, she felt it was her obligation to live up to the contract she'd signed. And was going to go to basic training. It was her duty, and she was going to live up to that. And so I think it was so incredibly courageous for her to say goodbye. And that's what she did. And we, as we stood outside, me, all my siblings, my mom, the recruiter, it was silent for a while. And then we heard just a wailing that I don't know how to describe outside of just the saddest sound I think a human can make. Almost like if you've, like 10 times worse than anytime you've heard a sad dog howl, because he thinks, or she, you know, the dog thinks its owners are leaving them behind. I'm just going to the grocery store, but you know, that sad dog sound, but worse. I almost hesitate to make that analogy, but we heard that. And then a second later, my sister comes out, you know, and she's emotional, you know, and it's kind of, you know, and then gives her final hugs to us and gets in the car. But I will never forget the courage it took for her to endure that, because man, even the most courageous, the most person that was full of resolve, hearing that noise out of your father, the deep sadness of, because my dad also knew he was saying goodbye to one of his daughters for the last time. He knew that he was saying goodbye for the last time. They both knew that. And so that deep guttural sadness that came out of him, and we all heard it. We could all hear it from outside. And the fact that my sister still had the strength to walk outside, wipe the tears, give us a couple more hugs, and then hop in the car and go. I'll never forget her for doing that, and never stop respecting her for having that level of resolve to go do that. But also, man, I'll just never forget that noise. I'll never forget the noise a human is capable of making at the deepest depths of sadness. That's something that really, you know, I've had a lot of different experiences that have absolutely changed the course of my life. That's right up there. That's right up there with not just my sister's actions and going through with everything and making that very hard decision, but also what it looks like to say goodbye at the end of life. Of a very premature death. So to kind of end the story, you know, she left, went to basic training in June. He died in first week of August. She was still in basic training. I still remember as he kind of went into his final 48 hours there and basically wasn't really conscious anymore, or at least not that we couldn't talk to him anymore, at least, right? Having to call down to basic training and, you know, put in the Red Cross message and get her back home. And, you know, of course, you know, she did get back home, but not in time to see him one more time. That in the end was the last time that she ever saw her dad alive. And I don't know, just everything about that is something that has changed the way I view the world. It changes the way I view some of my own previous experiences. It changed the way I see courage and resilience and some of these other intrinsic qualities of everybody thinks that they can be strong in that moment. But man, I'm telling you right now, if it were me saying goodbye, I don't know for a fact that I would have been able to go through with it after hearing that. I don't know for a fact. I'd like to think that I would still be able to do the same thing, but I don't know that for a fact. I don't think anybody could until they're right there in that situation. So anyways, that's my story. Kind of a bummer story. I wish I could tell a fun. I've got plenty of funny stories and things like that.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that. There's so much to, I feel like there's a lot to unpack there. A lot of things relevant. Yeah.
I've spent the last 6-7 years still unpacking that moment, you know.
Do you think courage, your sister's actions there, do you think that is something that she was born innately with, a quality, or is that something that was developed through the culture in your family? Is it something the way she was brought up, or is it something she was born with?
I'd like to think it's a little bit of both. You know, I'd like to think that, you know, I think all humans are born capable of courage and making tough decisions and the most dire circumstances. I think everybody's born with that capability, and that's the nature aspect of it. But the nurture aspect of it, I think, absolutely can wipe that capability away from you in some circumstances, you know, depending on how you were brought up. And then other places, you know, other circumstances that you're brought up in, I think it can absolutely celebrate those qualities and like engender or, kind of cultivate that quality and really bring it to the surface of a person's consciousness, to where they are, anytime they're faced with a tough situation, they just, at that point, it's automatic. It's they're going to make the hard right over the easy wrong. Or, and in this particular situation, I don't think it would have been wrong for her. I wouldn't call that the easy wrong by any stretch, but certainly the decision to still go was definitely the tougher decision to make. Right. You know, because nobody would have faulted her for sticking around, not a person. And the fact that she still went and did that, you know, and I don't know. I'd like to think that, you know, our family definitely values service and selfless service at that. You know, both my brother and I served in the military, and then my sister, one of my three sisters also joined. She's the youngest. I'm the oldest of five. She's the youngest of five. She actually just recently got promoted to sergeant. So she's now the second Sergeant Scoveland, in my, group of siblings. So I'd like to think that we are, you know, and I've seen, all of that out of all of my siblings, where we've made really tough choices in the face of, you know, unfavorable situations. And so I'd like to think that my parents had something to do with that. And then that larger village that influences you, because any parent knows it's not just you that's influencing your kids. It's the friends that you're around. It's the community that you grow up in. It's, I think all those things affect somebody. And I'd like to think that you know, we grew up pretty poor. My dad really never knew a day of comfort in his life. You know, a small town in South Dakota. And, you know, I'd like to think that a lot of those things all kind of came together to make the people that we are today and influence my sister on that day, you know, to where it wasn't really even a thought for her. I mean, maybe it was. I don't know how much you'd have to, again, I'm kind of telling somebody else's story. I just say it as a witness, you know, a true sort of journalist of the situation. You know, so she could tell you how much she maybe wrestled or didn't with that decision. But I'd like to think that it was just something that, no, this is my job. This is what I signed up for. This is the obligation. You know, I think that we'd all probably think that my dad probably, you know, as much as he probably didn't want to say goodbye right then, you know, also would have said, hey, the right thing is to go do what you signed up for, you know? So, I'm sure that probably played into it as well.
Well, you know, speaking of being a witness, being a journalist and kind of observing and then relaying a story, you know, you have a new book coming out, Send Me, The Incredible True Story of a Mother at War. I want to talk a little bit about that. Can you tell us who is Shannon Kent and why did you want to write this book about her?
Yeah, so Shannon Kent was you know, she held many titles. She was not only a naval cryptologist, a linguist, she was a mother, she was a sister, she was a daughter, she was a wife. She was a special operator at the highest levels of the military, a combat veteran five times over, and somebody who ran marathons, who was survived cancer, was back at work, had it cut out, and was back at work the next day, who had done both her undergrad as well as her graduate degree while on active duty, and then had been accepted into a doctorate program while on active duty. Somebody who went through not just one, but multiple special operations selections before she was working at that special operations level, before people were even talking about women in combat or whether that's right or not. She was just doing it. You know, that's who she was. And ultimately met an untimely death at in Syria in 2019. And, you know, that was my initial introduction to her, was the news headlines. And then shortly after that, her husband reaching out to see if I'd be interested in doing a story, and me going down to her memorial at the Naval Academy, and quickly realizing this isn't just anybody who just died. You know, this person was different. And then now, over the course of the last 5 years, trying to make sure that that story is recorded, not just for posterity and history's sake, but also so that her two young sons, who were 1 and 3 when she died, will know who their mom was someday. You know, so yeah, the long-winded way to say, she was an incredible person, an incredible human, and our I think our nation and our world is a little bit less in her absence.
Wow. So her husband, Joe Kent, reached out to you. Why did he select you, and what was your initial like reaction when he reached out and says, I want you to do some type of piece, some type of book about my wife?
Yeah. So he reached out to a mutual friend of ours, Evan Hafer, who was also my boss at the time. And they had some mutual friends, but this was, you know, a week and a half after I saw the initial headlines of the explosion in Manbij, Syria, and which she wasn't the only one that died in that. Scotty Wirtz, John Farmer, and Gadir Taher were the three other Americans killed, and then many, many more Syrians. But, you know, I'd seen the headlines, and so my Evan texted me. He's like, hey, I got a buddy, Joe. I don't know if you saw, but that explosion in Syria, but one of them was his wife, Shannon. I think you should talk to him. And so we ended up being connected, and we talked, and he told me he's, you know, kind of trying to get the story out. And I think he was initially mad at the way Shannon and her teammates were being characterized in the initial reporting, which was that they were all out to lunch, like it was some joyride that they were out on, and then, you know, something bad happened. And even me looking at, and I told Joe this at the time, I was like, yeah, just the initial news reports that I saw, when I saw Scotty Wirtz, former Navy SEAL, current DIA, Gadir Taher, Syrian-born American, John Farmer, Special Forces Warrant Offs, Shannon, like, you just start to put those, you're like, I don't think that this was the going out to lunch crowd. Right. You know, they were doing something, and so Joe was like, yeah, I think that this story needs to be told. And so the initial idea was just, I was going to write an article. I was going to profile her. And he'd reached out to many other writers as well. The New York Times wrote a profile on her, the Washington Post, as well as Stars and Stripes. Those are the three that really stand out to me. And I'm sure there was many more that had wrote about her in those initial ones. So he reached out to me. He told me that Shannon had read some of my stuff in the past and sent him some stories that I'd done. And so I know that Shannon had read some of my work before, and also he was just looking for somebody that, you know, he wanted her story to be told, and was going to multiple places, but of the places he went to, he wanted to make sure at least one of them had somebody that really understood Shannon's background.
Right.
And in my case, you know, also come from a special operations background, have also kind of, you know, I think earned a reputation of telling stories about people that come from that community, veterans in general, but specifically I've done a lot of work telling sort of those untold stories out of the special operations community. And so I think I was somebody that, like, okay, Marty at least needs to be in the mix here.
Right. And so, but you two never met.
No. It's entirely possible that, you know, Shannon's got a photo of standing right outside of my room, my CHU, in Iraq, in 2008. And, you know, so it's entirely possible we passed each other in the chow hall at some point. We worked in the same task force. It's entirely possible. Do I remember meeting her? No, I definitely never formally met her, you know?
Right.
And then, you know, the same is also possible of Joe. It's entirely possible we passed each other at some point somewhere, who knows, you know? We'd never formally met. And first time I met Joe was when I came down, shortly thereafter, I came down to DC to Annapolis, to attend the memorial. And that's when I met him and a bunch of other people that she worked with for, you know, the first time. And that's really what drew me into. I remember at the end of the morning, like that night, before I'd even written the article, I told Joe, I was like, hey, man, I'm sure you're going to get hit up about this, but I would love to throw my hat in the ring if you're thinking about a book. You know, I don't think I'm going to have the real estate to do Shannon justice in a single article. And the article that I did write was 5,000-6,000 words. I mean, it wasn't a short story by any stretch, and I still didn't feel like I even scratched the surface. And I did in retrospect.
So you've got, she was aware of you in some context. Maybe you were, you know, two ships passing in the night sort of thing. You ran in the same circles, but you never formally met. She knew your writing. Now you've had this emotional connection, right? That's where it starts. As you go down there, you experience that memorial ceremony, you meet her husband. Where do you begin to write a book, right? Like you said, you wrote the article, you did that, it was not enough. Where do you begin when you want to take on a full book?
I think that, are you talking process or once I actually started putting pen to paper?
Whichever came first.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, so when I told Joe, hey, I'd like to throw my hat in the ring, he was very noncommittal. I mean, he was very nice about it. He didn't say no. He also didn't say yes, you know, and I think that was his way of just like, hey, let's see how this story turns out and probably how the other folks' stories were going to turn out as well, you know. And so it was in May that my story, May of 2019, my feature on her published. And I mean, it wasn't long after I hit publish and sent in the link where, I mean, it was definitely the same day at least where he called me and was like, hey, yeah, man, like if you're still interested, let's do the book. And so then at that point, and of course it was like, yes, 100%. And so at that point we got linked up, with, our lit agent, Larry, and, he kind of told us like, okay, first step, we need to put a proposal together. You know, for as you know, Mike, fiction, you just turn in the full manuscript. Nonfiction, you write a proposal of what you will write. And then that's kind of what you sell the book off of. And so we got to work on the proposal. I remember I sent off the final draft of my proposal in October, the morning that I was stepping off to go hike Mount Kilimanjaro. And I like literally from the hotel in Moshi, Tanzania, hurriedly making the last few edits, hitting send, closing the laptop, and like they're waiting on me outside. That Marty, hurry up, like it's like we gotta go. It was like literally that last minute where I just finished up those last few things in the proposal. And the proposal, I mean, it was robust. That's a big part of the writing right there. You're writing a chapter by chapter breakdown, multiple paragraphs for each of those chapters, it kind of like an opening scene for each of them, and then like a paragraph or two of what else would be covered in that chapter, as well as two or three of those chapters are full chapters, and then, you know, a bunch of other, you know, author by, you know, all the other stuff that goes into that. So it was, I want to say our proposal was like 20,000-25,000 words. Like it was robust. And so, you know, I sent that off, and so you're already sort of writing the book at that point of, hey, you've really got your chapters break down, but you know, it could change based on who buys the book and they're going to have their thoughts. And, you know, I go and hike Kilimanjaro, come back, and, it was in, I want to say December, first or second week of December of 2019. We went down to New York to go do a bunch of meetings with, you know, our agent had gone out on submission and, you know, circulated it. And we had, I think it was three or four different places that wanted to meet with us. And you know, Joe and I came into New York, met with a bunch of different places, and the one that we felt best about was our editor Morrow, who is at William Morrow, the nonfiction division over at HarperCollins, and Morrow really got kind of where we were coming from as far as what we wanted to look like. We weren't looking to do a tell-all on the special operations unit that she was from. We weren't looking for that. We really wanted to focus on the human aspects of this, that, you know, the human experience of Shannon. And he was right in line with that and really didn't want a lot of changes to the structure that we had already sort of proposed. So we ended up making a deal with him. And then that was December 2019. I think we officially signed the contract like early January 2020. And what happens in early 2020, right? World turns upside down. And then, so as I'm just revving up, and I had all these things lined up to go start doing interviews and stuff, and then just everything shut down, can't travel. And then a bunch of the people that run in Shannon circles, you know, they're not really comfortable talking to the media, period. Never mind over the phone, you know, or over Zoom or something like that. So right off the bat, and then it's like, how do you write a book about somebody whose almost her entire professional life is classified and also isn't here to just talk to yourself? And you have to rely on her husband, who also was deploying all the time. And of course knew Shannon the best out of anybody, but like still wasn't there for every moment. And they had only been married for 6 years when she'd been killed, or at least together for 6 years. And then, you know, married for most of 5 years, maybe, when she was killed. And so you had to fill in all these other blanks of that. Like, so it was a tall task right off the bat. And Joe immediately started, I told him like, hey, if you can just start writing basically the love story between you and Shannon, just basically do journal entries. Right. And one of the initial ideas with the book is we were going to keep his stuff in first person and then all my stuff in third person. And then, you know, this ended up turning into a multi-year effort to write this book. Somewhere along the way, we ended up, the flow didn't work right to do that. And so we ended up making everything third person. And I think the book is better for it, definitely. But he started writing sort of the love story between him and Shannon. I started doing interviews and trying to unpack her military career. And we also figured out we don't really have an antagonist. We don't want this to read like one long Wikipedia entry about Shannon. You need stakes. You need something there. And that's where we arrived at. Well, when she was killed, she was going after the ISIS target deck and trying to find Baghdadi, al-Baghdadi, who is the leader of ISIS. And so we kind of decided to make him, even though she wasn't going after him the entire time she was in the military or anything like that, that was just who we identified. This will be the antagonist. We will simultaneously follow her rise through the military as Baghdadi and then more largely ISIS's rise to power. And then they'll both kind of meet at the end. And they don't literally meet in the literal sense. And I don't want to spoil the book for readers that are going to go check this out. But it largely worked. But that was one thing that we also added after we had sold the book is like, hey, we need some sort of antagonist here to have some more. So it just doesn't feel like, and then she did this, and then she did this, and then we wanted this to be narratively strong, you know, to keep people really engaged. And I forget where you even asked me now. I just write into writing the book, right? And so this was all part of it. And this kind of all unfolded over the course of, you know, between, like I said, spring 2020. And then, you know, I think we made the last final edits September, October 2023, last fall. I remember there was two final interviews that I did with friends that she did grew up with. Like right as we were like ready to do final accepted manuscript, like it was like last minute, like, oh my God, this book is so much better with these two people. And so it wasn't big parts, but we injected them into a few different parts in the book to give them their own little sort of mini character arc there. And I mean, so we were working right up until the buzzer. And in that process too, DOD pre-publication review, CIA pre-publication review, you know, I interviewed something like 40 some people, poured over any document I could get my hands on. There was a lot that went into this.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the storytelling component of this as a reader, right? Like I never met Shannon Kent. Like I didn't know about this story until I got this book. And yet I felt from her childhood to the end of her life pulled along. And I felt a sense of loss at the end. I did, which is really, you know, something I kind of want to unpack a little bit and figure out, why is this person I've never met before, there's an emotional pull in the center of my chest when she's killed, right? And I mean, like you said, you interviewed 40 something people for this from all different parts of her life too, right? Because we start off in her professional career, the opening is a very tense moment of a specific mission she's on, but it's one of many, right? Like you said, this is what she did for her professional career. She was involved for a while, right? And then after that opening scene, you go right back to her childhood and kind of start, like, you know, at the beginning of her life, more or less. And yep. we hear from her friends, we hear from her parents, we get these stories very quickly, and we begin to develop kind of an idea of who she is. My question for you is, like, with all the years of interviews and different people from different parts of her life and different phases of her life, how did you figure out, like, how did you pick the stories and the moments that you're like, no, this is getting down to past the surface level stuff to who Shannon really was?
Well, so one of the difficult parts in doing a book like this about somebody who people cared very deeply about and is no longer here is you get a lot of just sort of statements about her. Shannon was this, Shannon was that, or she did this. What you really, I think the job of the author is to try to pull out vignettes that they remember, that they can tell in some sort of detail. And so most of my, I think if you talk to, like, most of the people that I interviewed, they'll tell you that I really tried to get them to remember specific stories. Like, that's my go-to thing, is like, tell me a story about you guys. Like, tell me a story. And then from there, I can start to ask more details of, like, well, what were you wearing? What was she wearing? What were you said you were drinking. What were you drinking? You know, what did the room look like? Like, I try to get all these details that I need to be able to paint a picture. I think the best nonfiction books are ones where you can literally be watching the movie in your head as you are reading it. And I want to give that level of detail. And so, and again, I think that's also how you prevent it, again, from turning into just sort of one long Wikipedia entry, you know? And so that was really, and you'll see all those, like, little vignettes. We tried to just get enough stories to cover each sort of phase of her life. And for obvious reasons, we didn't want to spend too much time in childhood, you know? But I tried to look for things that, stories that, one, people could retell in great enough detail. When you're talking about when she's young, that's 30 years ago that you're trying to recall details, and that's difficult for most people. So not just that level of detail, but stories that foreshadowed who she would become later. You know, so there's one part in the book where, you know, we kind of open up with her bedtime routine when she was like a toddler, and her mom sings her this song, this Irish lullaby, and they read a certain book. Much, much later in the book, when Shannon's a mother, she's singing that same lullaby to her first child. And it's so there's some things that we use some of those stories to try to foreshadow later things, you know, some of the stories from high school where they're talking about her sort of early grasp of foreign language, right? That definitely foreshadows some fairly obvious elements of her story. But yeah, we really tried to get these things that we could come back to later, or would set up and build this more sort of complex, layered view of who she was. Like, I think if you can try from a storytelling perspective to grow an onion from the inside out, that's really what you're trying to do, you know, so that then people can peel that onion back and get to the center. I think that's what you're trying to do, to create a layered, nuanced version of who somebody was.
Before we get to the second half of our interview, I want to take a quick second to thank our sponsors. This week's episode is brought to you by FieldSeats.com. FieldSeats.com is an e-commerce, federally licensed firearms dealer. They provide virtual reviews on brand new firearms, optics, and gear, where at the end of the review, they give away the item being reviewed to an attendee. Currently, they've got reviews and giveaways up ranging from $20 for a brand new Smith & Wesson M&P Shield M2.0 9mm to $50 for a new Christensen Arms CA556. Each review has limited seating, so your chances of winning the giveaway are that much higher. Check out FieldSeats.com to purchase your reviews and enter to win the item being reviewed, and use the code LethalMinds to get 10% off your order. Be sure to also check out their Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube at field_seats for updates on products and other tips and info. Use code LethalMinds to receive 10% off your entire purchase at fieldseats.com. Terms and conditions apply.
Outside of that, you've got the actual information gathering and trying to figure out who this person was. But I mean, it's you know, plainly obvious, like you do have some similar experiences, like you said, come from similar communities, cross paths, but there's a lot that you are, have no personal experience with. She was a mother. She was a cancer survivor. She's very experienced with language. That's, like you said, established early on that she had this talent. She was like fluent in like 6 or 7 different and like highly fluent, not just like getting around a city, finding where the bathroom and where the restaurants are and being able to ask for directions, but like culturally fluent, right? And that's like something
totally off-putting different. For native speakers.
Right. And that's commented on several times throughout the book. So how did you overcome those challenges in that you're not a woman, you're not a mother, you're not, you've got tangential relations, you know, experiences that relate to these, but they're not your experiences. How did you overcome that?
So I think that's a big part of being a journalist, but I want to say right up front, it was not lost on me that me and Joe are two dudes writing about a woman's life. Right. And, you know, even Joe as her husband, though, but it's still like, hey, how do we get inside? I mean, this is, gosh, I've got so many different thoughts coming at me right now. It's like, okay, what do I tackle first, right? As a young writer, you're told, write what you know, because it's always going to be better. Write what you know, stay in that, and then you can kind of grow from there. And so definitely the easier parts for me to write in this were the aspects that I did know, like some of the combat sequences and things like that. That's just easier for me to know or to write because I know that. But yeah, when you're in the delivery room, okay, I don't know her perspective, but I know what it's like to be in a delivery room, right? You know, my wife has never had cancer, but my wife does have type 1 diabetes. I know what it's like to be concerned about the health of your wife. Right. I know what it's like to be separated from my wife and be away for long times doing dangerous things, right? Like I know a bunch of those different things. But to get the specific stories in this, a lot of times you'd have to unpack. Like there's one interview that I did with a SEAL that she served with, and you know, they were both in TF-17 together. I was in TF-17, and so he's like, yeah, we were out, you know, doing, you know, hits every night. And I'm like, okay. And so, and I kind of described my experiences. I was like, is that pretty much what you guys were doing too? I mean, because different strike forces. And he's like, yeah, man, like exactly that. So I was then able to go and kind of construct what was the typical Task Force 17 mission, right? Of how, you know, I know what a direct action raid looks like. So I was able to sort of write that out and recreate those scenes. Because they're all, you know, you do 10 of those, you've done them all, right? Like there's only so many different ways to write about raiding a building in Iraq, right? Like it's, and so we kind of recreated that. When she has the conversation with her doctor about cancer, well, I wasn't right in the room when she found out with the doctor. So I called a doctor and was like, hey, here was the diagnosis. How would you have sat down and explained this? And so I took him and used that dialogue to create that scene. And I think you're definitely skirting a line there of like, you've definitely need to be careful because this is still nonfiction, right? But that's where I had to be, you know, kind of explain in the author's note of like, hey, look, if we only went off of what we had transcripts for or something, just this wouldn't be what you wouldn't know anything about her. We had to take a few leaps in order to tell the truth of her experience, right? Like our job was to tell her truth. And by only going off of what was declassified and available, like you're not telling her truth, you know? And so we had to reconstruct some of those things. But yeah, you just, I think, yeah, you know, you're not there. So you got to talk to as many people that were there, as many people. And then, you know, once you've written all this stuff down and talked to as many experts as you can, you know, one of the things that I really relied on was sliding it by Joe, by people that knew her really well, her siblings, and hey, does this all sound like Shannon? Does this sound right? Like, does any of this jump out at you like, that's not Shannon? You know, I wanted this to the people that knew her best in this world, to when they looked at this, be like, oh my, this is Shannon. This is, you nailed it. Like, this is Shannon, you know?
What was that process like? Like, what was the initial feedback? How many rounds did you have to go through before they were like, this is it? Or did you nail it on the first time?
I think I think Joe and a lot of the people that saw earlier drafts, and really Joe was the only person for a long time that saw a complete draft, outside of the editors and stuff, but you know, other people. I think that Joe and a lot of the people that did see all or parts of this book early on, I think that they were okay with it. They liked the book a lot earlier than I did. I knew that I had a lot more work to do and that this could be a lot better, but they were looking at it and saying like, no, this is great. Like, I think at one point Joe was even like probably a little bit frustrated that there was still more work to be done on it. And not on his stuff, but just, you know, me trying to get this thing to where I felt I could look anybody that knew Shannon in the eyes and say, hey, this is, we did right by Shannon. You know, and nothing less than my full effort would be doing right by Shannon, you know? Yeah. And so I think that there was, I mean, there was many, many drafts. And I was still, you know, I was building a publication, my day job, I was building a publication from the ground up and, you know, had a lot of responsibilities in that way. And so you can talk to a lot of people that I worked with back then of, you know, I'm sitting there, we're driving somewhere and I'm in the back seat with my laptop open, trying to bang out, you know, revisions and things like that. It was definitely, I think, a labor of love at a certain point to just try to do right by Shannon and Joe and her boys. I mean, that's a lot of pressure to know, hey, Joe's going to give this book to his young boys someday and say, hey, this is who your mom was. You need to nail that. You know, you have to get that right.
Focus back in on Shannon a little bit. And just to go back to her story. So she starts off, she's part of this generation that joins in more or less the immediate aftermath of 9/11, right? Like she kind of at the end of high school, which is right before 9/11, she's interested in the military. There's this great scene, classic recruiter, you know, posted up outside the cafeteria, trying to pull the high school kids in. And she's interested in it initially, but you know, there's a heavy focus on pretty much all the pamphlets focus not only on men, but it's the combat operation stuff. It's the Navy SEALs with the face paint coming out of the lake with the rifles and all the rest of it. And that at the time, that's not even open to women, right? It's still, yep, most of that stuff still isn't, you know, it's been a slow change as far as allowing women into those communities. But, you know, there's this immediate dynamic that's set up that, you know, she's interested in that, doesn't end up happening. 9/11 happens. She tries college out and then she says, I'm enlisting. And she goes into the Navy. And it's interesting to watch her arc as she works her way into these communities, because going back to that initial image of like the typical guns, cool guy stuff, it's not really that. It's her intellectual capabilities that seem to kind of open the initial door, just a crack, you know, and she is, you know, physically capable and everything. But there's this idea that she subverts that, you know, it's not the typical path that she takes to get there. Could you talk a little bit about what that journey was like and, you know, capturing it?
Yeah, you know, I think that especially in the special operations community, the fact that you are physically gifted, you're in great shape is a given. That's just the standard, right? Yeah. But it's something that a lot of times support personnel or enablers, there's almost an expectation by the SEAL or the Green Beret or the Ranger or whatever that like, hey, support is probably not going to be in as good a shape as us. Probably not going to be as, and the fact that she showed up and was very physically gifted on that front, that bought her immediate credibility there. But then once she started getting into, she'd already sort of come in. So her first introduction to the special operations world was just because she volunteered as an individual augmentee on just a big Navy tasker, had no idea she was volunteering to go support a special operations task force in Iraq. She just knew it was a tasker for Iraq and wanted to get out of her windowless cubicle in Fort Gordon, you know? And that, which was her first assignment. And then she goes over there and then just sort of makes lemonade out of lemons right from the get go. And people start turning heads and like, oh, my God, she is an absolute, you know, force multiplier on the battlefield and off, for that matter. I mean, she was a signals intelligence analyst, a human intelligence analyst, but also a collector for both of those. Also a linguist. She was this like, multi-threat, like the triple threat. I don't know, probably more than that, but like could do it. She was a one-stop shop, whereas typically you'd have to go drop some stuff at the human desk, some stuff off at the SIGINT desk. Then it's got to get routed through the analysts and the linguists. And I mean, you know, reports that she was able to do it all, you know, and that I think she just, and that's where I'll say, I don't think that she aim to be a woman in special, like it, and nobody thought that they were making some big policy decision. It was just like, oh, we need you. You do something that we can't, come with us.
Right.
And it was just never even a debate, right? Like nobody said, is it okay that we take this woman and bring her along? It was just like, oh, this is the common sense thing to do. No different than I imagine a commander saying like, yeah, of course you should wear hiking boots. We're in Afghanistan, right? Right. Like, well, it's just like these common sense things that I think can be sometimes unique to the special operations community. Cause a lot of times on the conventional side, the leaders just don't have that latitude to make sort of autonomous decisions like that. I think on the special operations side, there was just definitely this, hey, we're fighting an insurgency. We're doing counterterrorism operations. We are trying to win a war here, and we need to use every tool at our disposal. We need to have the right people in the right places. And Shannon was the right person. Right. And so, you know, when she came over on that tasker, kind of got discovered, and then next thing she knows, she's going and to the direct support course, which was a brand new thing. She was the first woman to ever graduate the direct support course, graduated number 3 in her class out of all the men and everything like that, and then got her first assignment to the SEAL teams. And then she was in the SEAL teams for, you know, multiple deployments and multiple years before she ended up basically went as far as she could go with that. And then the only thing that was left was to go up to that next level. You know, that special, you know, sort of, you know, people often refer to it as tier one units, right? And so she wanted to go up to that next level, went to selection, passed. And then, and that's where she met Joe, was when she came after she passed selection for the training course that they go through for that. Joe had also went through that selection and, you know, and now, and Joe was a, you know, Ranger, Green Beret, then Green Beret warrant officer. And also, you know, so this is the sort of people that she was in league with, you know.
It's interesting because later in the, there's this one line that comes kind of late in the book, but it's touched on a couple of times. So when going back to the language thing, that she's operating at this fluency where it's deeper than just being fluent with the language. It's a cultural thing. And there's this line that says, it's just something you can't teach. It was something that she just brought there. Having looked at spent a couple of years looking at the full scope of her life and kind of relating back to the story you opened with, this idea of like, is this something you're born with or is this something that's cultivated? Was there anything that you saw that stood out to like what set her apart?
I mean, what didn't set her apart is really the question. I know I personally, I didn't meet anybody like her when I was in the military, you know, and I feel very privileged that I was able to be around some of the best humans that I think that I'll ever meet in uniform. And I still didn't meet anybody like Shannon. When you think about what set her apart, like her capacity for empathy and compassion while still being the cold, you know, cold-blooded killer, right? Like that's, you don't find that in a lot of people. You don't find a lot of people that speak languages like she did, multiple languages, but also had the capacity for analysis and collection and being able to pull information out of people. And still, you know, was into art. She's staying up all night creating mosaics. Like, and at some point in this book, you go, God, did she have the same 24 hours in a day that the rest of us have? Like, there's one touching thing that's, not a part of this story is in the book, but, I'll tell you the other side of it. When she's getting ready to go on her final deployment, one of her friends that she'd kind of come up through Navy boot camp and stuff with, you know, they touch base every so often, just like any of us in the military, right? There's people that early on you'll, you know, touch base every once in a while, but you're not talking to each other every day. And this friend that she had, they, you know, talked, I think it was maybe, you know, 2 or 3 days, I think, before she was set to deploy. And the friend was like, hey, I'm applying to this program. This medical program, could you write me a letter of recommendation? It would really help out. And Shannon told her, I'm like, I would do anything for you. I'm literally leaving you know, basically tomorrow. And I just don't have time. I'm so, so sorry. Like, is there any way that you could wait a little bit? But she was under deadline. And so it's just like, no, I totally understand. You know, Shannon goes on that deployment and her friend, you know, applies to this program without the letter. So she thinks, and, you know, Shannon, you know, she eventually finds out that Shannon was killed and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Months after Shannon died, this person found out she'd been accepted into the program. And in the packet, there was a letter of recommendation from Shannon that she wrote. She found time in those of everything that you have going on as you're getting ready to leave your kids and your husband and everything to go on deployment. And I mean, this was all right around Thanksgiving too. And they hosted Thanksgiving that year and just found the time to sit down and write a very well thought out letter of recommendation that helped her friend get into this program. And just, I can't think of how many times I disappoint people on stuff of like, hey, Mike, you're waiting for something from me right now. Right. Like, and just, she found a way, she found the time. She, when you think about just how did she set herself apart? Like, you know, I'll steal a line from the Marines, right? No better friend, no worse enemy. I mean, but to the, at the highest levels of both.
Right.
You know, how didn't she set herself apart? That's really the question. Very, very unique person. We don't just write a book about anybody. I'll put it that way.
That's definitely true. One final question for you. If there was, you've written a whole book now, you spent a couple of years of your life trying to figure out the best way to tell this story, a person who you've never really met and you've gotten to know in an intimate way. If there was one thing you wanted a reader to take away from this book, what would it be?
I hope that anybody that reads this book immediately finds inspiration and uses this book as a tool to inspire others. I can tell you my daughters will both read this book someday. My second daughter, her middle name is after Shannon. There's a story I won't tell publicly, but the reason I have my second daughter right now is in part due to Shannon. And you know, this will be a book that they read someday. I hope that people feel inspired, and I hope that when they get to that part in the book, they feel just even 1/1000th of the loss that Joe and her, the rest of her family felt when they found out. I really want people to understand the loss that our, not just her family, but our nation experienced by no longer having this very gifted person among us, but also finds inspiration from the way that she lived her life. So I don't know. I think that those are, people take away anything, it's to feel a sense of the loss and to feel inspired by the way she lived. So yeah, that's the first thing that comes to mind. But I think, you know, just to expand on that a little bit, we cover a lot of ground in the book. I think depending on the lens by through which you view the world and that through which you read this book, I think different people are going to take different things away from this, you know, certainly inspiration. I'm certainly anybody that reads this will think that she's just as incredible as I say she is, but I think that there's different things in here. We touch on mental health. We touch on relationship stuff, the nitty gritty of husband and wife, you know, and I'll give Joe a lot of credit for being as vulnerable as he was, as he made himself in writing some of those scenes. You know, it just, I think different people take different things away, I guess is just really all suffice to say that. And I hope they do. I hope this is just something that people can pick up and read a chapter out of at any time and feel a little bit more pep in their step that day. You know, I don't know.
No, I think you really succeeded in being a conduit, right? Like you said before, you're observing something. Even the story you started off with, you're observing something and amplifying it to a much, much larger audience. And I think you really succeeded here. And like I said, never having met her, not feeling the total sense of loss that her family, her husband could feel, and yet still feeling like I'm a little bit closer to that story. So very, very excited to see this book come out into the world, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, I'm anxious to hear what the world thinks about the book. So yeah, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
Be sure to order Send Me wherever books are sold.
Literature of War has always been about getting books into the hands of our troops, those men and women who are currently serving all over the world right now. we are right in the midst of our first platoon book club initiative. The premise is simple. We get the books to the troops along with discussion questions and other resources, as well as some Lit War merch. They have the discussions as a platoon, and then they write about their experience, all free of charge. Through our support, we aim to cultivate a stimulating environment that not only prepares our servicemen and women for their duties, but also nurtures their personal development. Please head to the link in our description for ways to donate. Once again, I'm your host, Michael Jerome Plunkett, and I will be back in a few weeks with another story and another conversation.
Veterans Radio has a partnership with Literature of War Foundation to exchange podcast content to reach a wider audience regarding issues of interest to veterans, family, and friends. You can find more about Literature of War Foundation at its website, litofwar.com. You can find more about Veterans Radio on Facebook or its website, veteransradio.org. I am Jim Foss-Hone, a host of Veterans Radio and a veterans disability lawyer at LegalHelpForVeterans.com, a sponsor of this podcast.